Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Safety Matters, the podcast for food safety professionals. I'm Stacey Acheson, publisher of Food Safety Magazine, and I'm here with Barbara Van Renterham, Cowboys fan, and Tiffany Mayberry. I don't know, Tiffany, can we call you a Cowboys fan?
No, you cannot.
No, we cannot.
Not okay. A football fan. Sorry,
not
guys.
Not a football fan. Okay, I'm sorry. All right. So, Barbara, in addition to being a Cowboy fan, is our editorial director. Tiffany Mayberry is our digital editor. And me. So there you go. Here we are. The gang's all here. It's before Thanksgiving that we're recording this. So, you know, we're having our pre-Thanksgiving. We haven't had our turkey yet, so you guys, you know, bear with us. You all have had your turkey by the time you hear this episode, but just to put a little context on things. All right. Today's episode will feature Barbara's interview with Dr. Maria Lipinski, a joint professor in the Department of Communication and Michigan Ag Bioresearch at Michigan State University. Maria has joined us specifically to discuss risk communication, an incredibly important topic for the food industry, which we're sure you'll benefit from. We'll start the episode with a look at some recent food safety news, like we do. But before we do that, we want to remind everyone, as we mentioned in our last episode, that we'd like to include your feedback in our year-end episode that's going to be airing on December 11th. For that episode, we're going to be sitting down with our colleague Bob Ferguson for a look back at this year in food safety, as well as a little peeking into the future for what might be on the horizon for 2019. And we'd love for you to reach out and share your thoughts about your year in food safety. What was your biggest challenge or success? What were some of your lessons learned? Maybe you had a favorite episode. Whatever's on your mind, we'd love to hear it and include you in the episode. And to share your thoughts with us on this year in food safety or about anything that we've discussed on the podcast this year, please send us an email at podcast@foodsafetymagazine.com or reach out via our social channels, LinkedIn, Facebook, or Twitter. Or, you know, my favorite idea, because I'd love to hear your voice and share it on the podcast, record a voice memo on your phone and email it to us. We'll need to get your input by December 5th, so don't wait. We want to hear from you. Okay, Tiffany, now it's time for the news.
Let's do some news. Okay, so initially we came across a report on Food Safety News stating that the USDA had no plans to name any company in connection with an ongoing salmonella outbreak linked to raw ground turkey products. Later, that exact same day that we heard that news, USDA ended up announcing that the popular brand Jennie-O was recalling over 147,000 pounds of raw ground beef products. The recall was prompted after USDA and CDC collected an unopened meat sample from one of the 164 sick patients. That patient and their ground turkey sample tested positive for the outbreak strain, which is Salmonella reading. As the agencies continue to investigate, USDA says that additional product from other companies might be recalled as well. In addition to the 164 illnesses in 35 states, this outbreak did also cause at least one death.
Well, we were originally drawn to this one because they were not USDA, who's supposed to name the products, unlike FDA, who's recently just said that they will name the products. Didn't name the products, we thought was very unusual.
Hold on. FDA had said that they were going to start naming the retailers who were on the receiving end of recalled products.
That's right. Well, we thought that was odd that there was some, you know, shifting of roles here or practices, not really roles, but practices. So that's what first caught our attention, but I did say before we got started, poor Jennie-O, right at Thanksgiving. Yeesh. That'll put a hole in your holiday sales.
Yeah, not good.
not good. So, and to the point, right, even though it was ground turkey, people tend to just say, oh, Jennie-O turkey, I won't be buying that.
Mm-hmm. So we know that people were religiously contacting Ask Karen at USDA for cooking and roasting instructions for their holiday turkey. But And I didn't realize this until I got a very important email from the CDC today, that CDC has a food safety section of their website and has food safety tips for your holiday. So if you missed it for Thanksgiving, you can check it out before you bake your goose or your ham or your whatever you make for Christmas. So www.cdc.gov/food safety. So food safety
and
tips for
ask
the holiday.
Karen.
So.
And that's from CDC. And then there's askkaren.gov.
Right.
Yes, our favorite. And by the time you're hearing this, be the week after Thanksgiving. So if you're still eating turkey, stop.
You need to make the soup over the weekend after Thanksgiving. So the time of turkey soup and turkey burritos and turkey pot pie and shepherd's pie, which is William's favorite here. So it should be all done.
Turkey sandwiches. Yeah.
But the question is then, is it fresh cranberry sauce or Ocean Spray cranberry jelly in the can with the ribs?
I hate to admit it. It's canned. I'm a canned girl all the way. It's ridiculous, I know, but I guess that's my childhood, you know. That's what we did, so that's what I do.
What about you, Tiffany?
Or you could just opt for no cranberry sauce, which is my choice. No football, no cranberry sauce.
Yeah. Wow. No football, no cranberry sauce.
I don't know about you, Tiffany. I don't know. I mean, I am a Cowboys fan.
That's awesome.
And Dallas is kind of synonymous with Thanksgiving, you know, always Cowboys game.
Hey, but we kind of digressed a little bit here, you guys, because we were on this whole turkey thing. And when we were getting ready, we were on the Jennie-O recall. And when we were just getting ready to record, we were talking about this story and talking about how it affects a brand, you know, and how it affected Jennie-O for this. Tiffany shared that when the peanut outbreak happened, that she just threw away all her peanuts. You just threw everything away. It didn't matter what it was, who it came from.
I did. I never took the time to look up what brands were recalled or anything. I just kept seeing it on the news, and I'm like, let me trash all of this peanut butter. I think I had about three containers of peanut butter.
Yeah.
Threw it all out.
And see, I'm the opposite. I say, oh, what was the UPC code? And I write it down and I go check everything. We will have to report whether.
Ever the scientist. Well, are you sure there isn't some librarian in there, Barbara?
Oh.
Yeah,
those
maybe.
Are comments for another day. But I'm thinking that maybe we should look at whether there's any impact on turkey sales once the holiday has passed. It would
well,
be interesting to
yeah,
track
it's
that,
a, just so. A heck of a time. And obviously, USDA feels that there may be some other companies. They're not, maybe that's why they were hesitant, because they weren't certain that it was just Jennie-O, or, you know, obviously they want to be careful, because it can not just scuttle brands, it can scuttle a whole category.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right? So recalls, anyway, it's important that they're handled properly. So, and I guess by mention of the peanut butter and your reaction to peanut butter, it's a perfect
yeah, we got
lead
some
in.
Sort of peanut butter related news here. So the PCA Parnell case, which we've covered quite a bit on the podcast, I think it was a bit earlier this year, though. So the latest there is that the U.S. Supreme Court has denied Michael Parnell's request for an appeal. It's over. It's finally
it's
over.
It's really, 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 really over, you guys. This is it.
Yeah,
I think
this is it.
Well, there may be some other related story, but not about these guys.
So,
anyway.
But to be clear, this was not about peanut butter. It was about peanut butter paste that was used in other things. So not the jar that you make your kid's sandwich with, but just to be precise.
So you'd have to be throwing out half your pantry.
That's right.
So since this appeal was denied, this means that the Supreme Court will not oversee any more requests related to reviewing PCA's criminal convictions. Now, for anyone who needs a refresher, back in 2008 and 2009, PCA's peanut products were at the root of a multi-state salmonella outbreak that caused 9 deaths and sickened thousands of people. The Parnell brothers, along with PCA's former quality manager, Mary Wilkerson, were all sentenced to federal prison time ranging from just 5 years up to 28 years.
Yeah. And let's be clear, Barbara, what was it there they found? They had some test positive tests. And then the infamous email.
Yeah, finished product tests that came back positive, and so they decided to ship it to another lab, which, you know, it's all risk analysis. You know, not 100% of the product is contaminated, so they made sure they had a negative test, and then they shipped, knowing that they had a problem.
But the email, the smoking gun email was, ship it anyway. Yeah. But all this is about risk communication too. We were thinking about that, you know. I mean, so much of what this industry is about, and recalls and handling this stuff, is about risk communication. All timely topics for today's interview.
You can keep up with industry news and all of Food Safety Magazine's content by visiting our website, foodsafetymagazine.com. You can also join us on social media. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn by searching Food Safety Magazine.
Okay, so now we're going to hear Barbara's interview with Dr. Maria Lipinski, who is joint appointed as a professor in the Department of Communication and Michigan Ag Bioresearch at Michigan State University. She served as the Associate Dean for Research for the College of Communication Arts and Sciences, and in that role, facilitated interdisciplinary research partnerships and identification of funding sources for faculty research. Dr. Lipinski received her doctorate in 2000 from MSU and her Master of Arts from the University of Hawaii, Manoa. Her research examines the impact of messages and social, psychological factors on health and environmental risk behaviors, with a focus on culturally based differences and similarities. To this end, Dr. Lipinski has conducted collaborative research projects with her students and colleagues in a number of countries in Asia, the Pacific Rim, Central America, and Africa. And her work has been presented at national and international communication and public health conferences and published in many refereed journals.
What I found really interesting when I was speaking with her is that she was able to give a lot of examples from a different background than we normally hear in food safety. So she had examples from public health perspective that wasn't necessarily related to food, but I think it made me think that you don't really need to reinvent the wheel, that we can learn from a lot of other disciplines. Mm. And she really brought that perspective. So it was great to hear that.
All right. And without further ado, let's hear that interview.
Well, hi, Maria. Thanks for joining us on our podcast today.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk to you.
I'm looking forward to speaking with you about your work on risk communication, particularly as it pertains to the food industry. So let's get started. I'd like to begin to really set the stage for the work that you do as an academic researcher at Michigan State, looking at the courses that you teach on risk communication were really interesting to me. And a couple of the classes, special topics on risk communication, and also health communication for diverse populations, those really caught my eye. So I'd like you to start introducing these courses to our listeners and what you hope that your students can take away from what you teach them.
Well, great. That's a great place to start. Both of those courses are part of something called a Health and Risk Communication Master's Program, but they also attract people from across MSU who are interested in risk communication issues or interested in health or culture, because those classes both deal with those issues. Our health and risk communication program is really designed to bridge theory on communication with practice and to get people ready for jobs in the field. We have a 90% placement rate in that program in the field of health and risk communication.
Wow.
We also get people ready to do a doctorate in that field if they're interested in doing that. So it's a really great program. I love teaching in that program, and it's affiliated with a research center I direct, so I'm really passionate about the students in that program. The risk communication class is focused on issues associated, obviously, with risk communication. That's the title. But risk communication is a very interdisciplinary field. You have people from across psychology, communication, social psychology, business, management, who study how people understand risks and then how they make decisions about risk and ultimately what the actions that they take around risks. And so we really focus in on understanding these major areas of research and the theories of how people engage in risk communication, but then also how risk communication is enacted in our daily lives, how risk information is provided through the media, and then also really coming to understand what are the tools out there for people who want to do risk communication activities or who will be working in fields where risk communication is necessary. What are the tools available? And then we practice using those tools as part of the course. So that's sort of the sort of nuts and bolts of that course. The Health Communication for Diverse Populations course really is about the ways in which culture influence our health behaviors, our risk behaviors, our decisions, etc. And we take what we call a One Health or a global health approach, where we look at the intersection of human health, animal health, and ecological health. And of course, food-related issues are quite, you know, cut across all those areas. What we look at in that class is the research and theory and practice on how people consider cultural dynamics in their practice, in their theories, et cetera, when they're designing communication campaigns or interventions to promote particular behaviors. We know from our own research that this is an important issue, and hopefully we'll talk more about that as we move through our conversation. But ultimately, I'd like my students to be able to design their own communication campaign or a research project that accounts for cultural diversity in some way in the design of that campaign or in the design of that study using what we learn in the class. So applying the lessons of the class. So that sums up kind of both those classes.
Yeah, I think that's diverse populations are, of course, very important in the food industry as ingredients are sourced from around the world and food is supplied between countries. So, I'm looking forward to diving deeper into that in a little bit. Now, food processors have a little balancing act to play, I think, when it comes to risk communication, because they need to be able to effectively communicate when there might be a risk from their product, such as cooking instructions or food preparation. But certainly they don't want to scare their consumers by providing too much science and explanation or scaring them from even buying the product to begin with. So what recommendations might you have for how a food processor could develop an effective risk communication plan just in general? And we'll consider maybe a recall event next, but just on their day-to-day business activities, how should a food processor think about this?
Well, a couple of things I'd like to highlight on this issue. First of all, our research shows that many consumers operate under the idea that someone else is largely taking care of the risks associated with products, and that someone else may be the producer, it may be somebody in the supply chain, it may be a regulatory agency. So that's sort of an important caveat here that in the best possible world, we should be focused on creating products that don't involve a lot of risk, right? So that we don't have to address this in our daily interactions. But obviously, there's a lot of particularly consumable products that have some kind of risk associated with them. The other thing I would highlight here is, as many of your listeners will know, there's guidance and mandates around how risk is communicated. And those often, that guidance may come from the FDA, it might be come from other agencies, but oftentimes this guidance or these mandates are not necessarily grounded in the risk communication science. Now, that is, I'm not, you know, being a researcher, I see that science is very important, but I understand how those mandates are created and that guidance is created. But I do want to highlight that issue. There's been a sort of long history of people who study the process of risk communication and know about that process trying to help create the guidance or to help consume or help producers be better at communicating risks associated with products. And that can, that has been sort of a historical frustration. Mm-hmm. There is something called the best practices for risk communication that exists. They were actually, they've been developed over time and they were promoted a lot by the National Center for Food Protection and Defense. And that was a consortium of industry and government and academics looking at how to better communicate risks associated with intentional contamination events. Those practices, although they're not really, there's not a lot of research or science behind some of them, they do highlight where the important areas are for risk communication around food-related issues. And just they can apply to both emergency events where you have something like a recall or something else, or you have an intentional contamination event, but they also kind of apply to everyday risk communication. And these include things like remembering this idea that risk communication is an ongoing process and it should be something that is planned for and very thoughtful and strategic. It includes things like coordinating with credible sources of information and collaborating as you go through the risk communication process. Addressing the role of the media in the risk communication process is an ongoing thing. These are some of these best practices. Now, I don't know if you want me to go through each one of these practices or not. It kind of depends on how much time you want to spend on this issue.
I'm thinking that one of the main challenges, and I guess I'll see if you agree with my supposition, is that processors have historically, I think, like pre-internet, been able to establish trust with their customers so that when an event occurred, they could rely on that good rapport that they had with their consumers. But as we've seen over the years, social media and the internet in general has really, you know, once people start spreading information, correct or not, it's really hard for the food industry to catch up. And they've had to learn a lot of things very quickly. So if we could spend some more time talking about how the, you know, you alluded to it briefly, just how the media environment has changed and has become a major challenge.
Yeah, so the new media environment has certainly changed the game in the communication world. And I think one thing that you said that's really important is this idea of catch up. Part of what we try and talk about in risk communication courses is really planning, right? So creating risk communication plans in the event that for the events that could occur, this means a more anticipatory process, right? And that is somewhat different from this sort of everyday, you know, how do you cook this appropriately, et cetera, right? But what you see from most companies is that they're engaging, or they should be if they're not, engaging in media monitoring at all times. And this includes a significant social media monitoring and active engagement with consumers that is an ongoing, consistent part of the way that they do business. That way, they are aware of trends in the communication environment. They have used social media to build rapport with people, and they're not being reactive, right? So it used to be that communication with consumers happened through events or focus grouping around marketing activities. Media monitoring is something that's always gone on, but it has become even more important in the social media age that brands are watching the social media environment and engaging even when major events aren't happening. When you see consumers who are unhappy with products or whatever, I've heard about engagement around Twitter posts about a particular project on the part of various companies. So this is a sort of trend that we're seeing that is a way to be proactive in the media environment today. Now, this is not something that I study or research, so I just want to kind of caveat all this. This is just something that is a trend that we're seeing when I interface with companies and folks from around the world who are doing communication activities.
So you referenced a few minutes ago some of the different practices that a company can undertake as they develop a risk communication plan. So if you could name the top two practices that you think maybe processors should adopt if they're not already, what would those be?
Well, so something that I teach in my courses, and I really frame all my sort of thinking about communication processes, is the idea that you start with audience, right? You start with your consumer when you're thinking about risk communication processes, and that there's a constant opportunity for engagement and feedback with the consumer. That is something that underlies, everything that we do in communication, is really coming to understanding the needs, the values, the risk perceptions, the existing behaviors of the people who are using your products or using your services. That to me is kind of a key issue. Mm-hmm. And that involves creating these relationships with people who use your products and continuing to foster that relationship and understand that relationship and understand those people. The second big thing that I think is a stumbling block, particularly when you have some sort of major event, is how people handle uncertainty or ambiguity. What we see from our research is that is when people, for example, may turn to their social groups for information. It is also a time when information processing kind of changes. So I think that acknowledging and addressing and accepting uncertainty and finding mechanisms for addressing uncertainty are another big sort of key part of the risk communication process. And then the final thing, I know you said two things, but I'm going to give you one more. And that is, we see from health risks and environmental risks that if you can give people meaningful actions to do and are very specific about those actions that will help avert a threat or a risk. So if we're talking about a recall, for example, very specific steps that people can do to protect themselves from dealing or using the product or, whatever the recall deals with, we call that in the literature building what's called self-efficacy, giving people a sense of control over the risky situation or the threatening situation. This is something that comes out again and again in the research as influencing people's decisions to act. So I think that's another major point I want to emphasize.
Now, kind of traveling down that road a little bit, do you find that over time people get information overload, that even if you're giving them specific instructions what to do with that, you know, lot code of product that has a risk of contamination, that people tune things out, or they're getting too much information and they're not sure how to prioritize? Does that come out in your research at all?
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, that's something that's been true over time and is even more true in the new media age, right? Because it's not just your recall event that's coming through their information channels as a risk, right? So ironically, social media has both sort of opened the door to all kinds of new information, but it's also narrowed the kind of information we're exposed to. So what I mean by that is it's possible these days to be bombarded with risk information. It's also possible, depending on the media outlets that you're using, that there's an algorithm that's determining exactly what kinds of information or what sources of information you're exposed to. So that's a sort of irony of the information age today. We know from research that people can be overwhelmed by the information they receive. And that's something that, you know, that's a tough problem, right? Because it's not just your recall event that people are processing. It's all kinds of risk information that's mm-hmm. coming in. One thing that we see from our own lab is, you know, first of all, there's often a need for people to seek out information, right? Rather than just assuming that the usual channels are going to reach them, right? So motivating people to seek out information is something that's been a real point of interest in the risk communication literature. That is even more important when you've got algorithms driving information exposure, right? And what I mean by that is if you're a Twitter user, or if you're a Facebook user, or if you're an Instagram user, right? There's algorithms that determine the new things coming into those feeds. And because of that can limit the scope of information that you're actually exposed to be more similar to what you're already getting, right? So if there's channels or sources that are outside of your typical feed, you're not being exposed to those necessarily, right? So it's necessary in some cases for people to seek out information about a risk, to figure out what to do, to find out what the steps are that they can take to protect themselves. And that's different from the idea of just like as a producer, we're putting information out there, right?
That's interesting. So do you think that happens because people are more trusting of feeds that are similar to what they generally look at, that's why those algorithms exist? And do you have any information, any numbers on how many people actually take the time to research and figure out what the next steps are, or do most people just rely on what they're being essentially fed?
It depends how important the risk is to them, right? So one of the big things that drives information seeking is what we call involvement. That is, how important is something to me, right? So for me to move outside of my, you know, typical channels or sources, I have to really care about that mm-hmm. issue. And so it's a matter of, at least in the health world, part of what we do is try and enhance people's sense of how important an issue is. There's lots of cases where people receive information from a provider or whatever in the health realm where that motivates additional information seeking. it's harder to do that with other topics, mm-hmm. right? So when you are, because a lot of information seeking is what we'd call just in time, right? We're not seeking out information about breast cancer risk unless we have information coming in that suggests that we might be at risk for breast cancer or we might have breast cancer, right? So figuring out how to do that with other topics where you don't have, you know, that immediate building up of your sense of the importance of the topic is part of the challenge, particularly in the, I think in the food safety world. Mm-hmm. I want to say one other thing here, and that is that we've talked a lot about the media environment, but our research also focuses really on the social networks and our social networks, non-mediated networks, mm-hmm. right? So our interpersonal networks, and those continue to play an important role in our perception of risks, our behavioral decision, et cetera.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because something interesting that happened within the past couple of years at a food meeting that I was at, someone was speaking in a session and asked the audience, and these are all food safety people who should know better, listeners, pay attention now, and asked how many people use an instant read thermometer when they're cooking a burger, for example. And less than half the audience, you know, admitted, you know, that they use an instant read thermometer. Every single hand should have gone up in a case like that, because in principle, this is the audience that best understands this risk. And so
we all study things, right? Or we all do things that we're not good at, right? Right?
So, you know, it is interesting that even within this, you know, social network, so to speak, of food professionals, you still have different perspectives about how great the risk really is. So that's interesting.
Well, yeah, just to piggyback on that a little bit, what we know from years and years of research is the attitude-behavior relationship is not a perfect relationship. And what that means is, even though I think it might be a good idea to use a thermometer, I still don't use a thermometer every time. And the reason is because your attitude is not the only thing that influences your actions. There's a whole sort of sphere of things that influences your decision to take an action. And your attitude, whether or not you think it's important to do that, that's only one thing, right?
That's interesting. I was wondering.
Well, and it's everything from access questions, right? Do you have a thermometer that works? That's a real simple, right?
Sure.
It can be, is your partner or your wife or your husband standing over you and thinks you should use one, right? Or do you know how to use one? There's a whole host of things that can change our decision to act on a positive attitude. They're strongly associated with one another, but not perfectly associated with one another.
Well, I was one of the ones who did raise my – I do go out with my ThermoPen just to make sure. But 10 years ago or 10 and a half years ago before I got involved with Food Safety Magazine, I don't think I ever went out with a thermometer. So I guess I'm the consummate scientist that once I was aware that this was really important, kind of changed my behavior. But maybe I'm the exception rather than the rule.
Well, there's been a lot of effort. I remember when I first sort of got exposed to the food safety world, that was, I don't know, 12 years ago at this point. And that was when there were a whole bunch of campaigns around thermometer use. And, you know, I haven't kept up on where those campaigns are right now, but it's certainly been an ongoing effort to try and provide people with the appropriate information about thermometer use. I don't know this from research, but I do know that what we see in a lot of communication campaigns is they oftentimes focus in on providing people with information, right? So the knowledge side of things, influencing people's awareness, or just, you know, they just need to know that they should be using a thermometer, whatever. And they less often focus on these other factors that I just mentioned, like self-efficacy, like access, like attitude. So it may be, and I don't know this from research, but from research on the thermometer issue particularly, but if you look at other health communication and environmental communication campaigns, they tend to be more education-focused, information provision-focused, and less focused on influence as we think about it in our field, or less explicitly focused on influence, I should say, even though they really, their ultimate goal is to influence people's behavior. They're really just providing people with information in many cases and not being very strategic in the design of the information to persuade people to actually use a thermometer.
It sounds like something that's something else that food industry professionals can think about a little bit more, not just providing information to their customers, but doing it strategically to try and influence behavior. That's something important to keep in mind.
Well, it's something when I teach a risk communication class, I say, start with what is the goal of your communication activities. And, you know, you want to be careful because there's ethical issues here, et cetera, around the concept of persuasion or influence. But it is worth keeping in mind, you know, what is our goal as communicators? Do we just want, you know, the information to get out there? Do we want to raise people's awareness? Do we want to influence behavior ultimately or whatever?
Yeah, that's a really important point. If we can shift gears a little bit and go back at the beginning. You talked about the course that you teach for diverse populations. And obviously, the food industry is very diverse. Ingredients, like I mentioned earlier, are sourced around the world. And even within a single food plant, you have diverse populations employed. So from your research, have you discovered any trends in how risk information is communicated globally and if different cultures perceive or define food safety risk differently?
So our research, and I alluded to this a little bit early on in our discussion, our research really operates under the assumption that for health, environmental, food risks, you need to take an audience-driven or a consumer-driven or a, you know, organizational member-driven approach to communication. What that means is we know that for any particular group, they are going to differ in terms of how they perceive a risk, what the environment is for risk protective behaviors, their social environment, the existing practices, et cetera. So if you are engaging in risk communication to a particular cultural group or group of people, our research is really premised on this idea that you start with understanding that group because of the fact that our studies show over and over again that even understanding what is perceived as risky varies from group to group. So it may be country to country at a very macro level. It might be smaller, like social groups or organizational groups. But it's clear from our research that there's cultural dynamics that exist that influence the way people respond to information about a risk or a health issue. So our research very much shows that it's that starting with the population or the people with whom you'll be communicating is the best way to address this.
Can you give us some examples of what you've seen maybe in different parts of the world that kind of illustrate these differences.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't, I guess there are food issues tied up in this, but just an example, a study that we did a few years ago in the Yucatan region in Mexico. We saw, so we started very much with a community-based approach to understanding what are the big, this was a health risk study in particular. If I kind of give the big picture here, we were seeing a large number of facial deformities in a particular region. And I was working with some people in particular who study cleft palate. And so we were trying to understand, okay, what is the cause behind this? What is the reason behind this? And how do people think about the risk factors associated with children being born with cleft palate? And so we started first at a very broad level, trying to understand what do people see as the risks in this community in particular. So what are the big environmental risks, health risks, et cetera? And this particular topic didn't even come up, okay? And the topics that came up were other issues that were important to community members, right? And so we studied what those big issues were. But ultimately, we were interested in, you know, is there a way to prevent all this excess number of cleft palate cases in this particular region? So one risk factor for cleft palate is a mother's health during her pregnancy. And we dove into that topic and talked to women in that region about the things that they ate, their, you know, the health care that they were receiving, what they saw as the risks to their unborn child. And we found a list of risks that women saw in that region that wouldn't be typical for women in other regions around the world. So I've done work on maternal and child health in a variety of countries around the world. And what you see is how women interpret their pregnancy, how they see what they see as risky, what behaviors they are willing to engage in or not, how they interface with the healthcare system. This is all dependent on where they live, who they surround themselves with, what the resources are within that particular community. So in this particular community, for example, pregnancy was not seen, it was seen as just everyday, part of everyday life, not something that you would go to see a doctor about. And so many women weren't, for example, seeking out prenatal care, and that was one of the reasons, right? Another reason was their access to the kinds of prenatal care that they wanted, right? So they didn't believe they had access to that care. We also looked at how their partners and the people in their social network talked to them about the risks associated with pregnancy. And we saw a particular set of risks or behaviors on the part of partners that we have not seen in other populations. So that's an example of some real concrete, like, you know, differences in risk perception associated with maternal health that you see in a particular region that we haven't seen in other places.
You know, it's interesting, the whole notion of these cultural differences. I've talked to a number of folks who, in order to change behavior, getting back to you stating that first you have to decide what the goal is of your risk communication. And the goal in this case was to change behavior. So if you have sanitation shift workers that you can engage in a way to connect the dots, so to speak, cause and effect, that if they take these actions in their important work doing sanitation, then they will be able to protect public health. In the training that I've heard about, you know, trying to connect the dots that, you know, your actions could save, your neighbor's child who eats the food that your company produces, and connecting the dots to in terms of a cause and effect. And it sounds like in this region of Mexico, there's some of that at play, that that these women who were pregnant didn't understand that the prenatal care, if they were able to have access to that, if they demanded that, if they saw a physician during their pregnancy, then the end result would be, you know, lower number of babies born with cleft palate. So, you know, maybe connecting the dots, you know, in a similar way in what you found in that region.
Yeah, I mean, that's a key set of dynamics that can make risk communication more effective, right? Giving people, it's this building efficacy idea that giving people something that they can do, and we have another, of course, academic term for what you're talking about, which is outcome expectations, right? What am I going to see as the outcomes of my action? Making those very explicit for people helps to motivate them to take particular actions. If they see, you know, if I do this, this happens, and that that thing is very important to them, that's like a perfect scenario right. for motivating people, right?
I'd also like to talk about some research that you did in Michigan with some farmers, and how this particular group seeks information and what their perspectives are on how they prefer to get the information. And why this really struck me is I've been asking people in the food industry for years, you know, as Food Safety Magazine, we know the people we're reaching pretty much, but when we think about, you know, smaller processors or cottage industries, you know, these people aren't going to these food safety meetings. They're, you know, not surrounding themselves with peers who read the magazine necessarily. So it's like, how do I reach those people? And it seems like a lot of these are either family-owned businesses or things have been done the same way over and over and over, and they've never had a problem, so they're not really interested in changing behavior. So I'm hoping maybe you can shed some much-needed light on how small producers, farmers, restaurant owners, retailers obtain information on food safety, and how we can get information to folks who are kind of outside, you know, the big companies with deep pockets who send their people to meetings and have a focused food safety team, those smaller groups.
Well, so the research that you're referring to is pretty old at this point, but one thing that it showed that we see continually in our research, and part of it is, you know, when you have a hammer, everything looks like right. a nail. We study social networks, but we know from a variety of health risk environmental behaviors that people go to their social networks for information about a variety of topics. And when problems arise, they go to their social networks. So you see in the health world, there's been a real effort to tap into what we would call, you know, this is an old term, but opinion leaders, but people who are key within particular communities that connect people, that share information with other people, that are the people that individuals go to when they have a problem. We see that in our research. You see that in the health health risk world, there's been very concerted efforts, for example, in HIV prevention, diabetes, other places, to tap into those social networks through people who are identified as being opinion leaders within that, within local networks. And so that is, you know, that's one inroad, is to identify within communities or groups people who are the ones who people go to for information. And what we see typically, unfortunately, is at least in some work we've done recently with livestock herders, and this is overseas, but what we see is most often what motivates people to look to people for information is when something goes mm-hmm. wrong or when they have some kind of problem. So that speaks to what you're talking about a little bit. It still doesn't speak to this sort of preemptive communication to people, but I can say that going in through these social networks is an option that I think is hard to tap into, but is important. You know, the other thing that I just want to reinforce is there are regulatory processes that are in place where people from like local public health, local environmental health, local, people from the local food safety communities are going out and meeting with individuals. This is another place where there's a potential to do more proactive or constructive information exchange. There's been efforts historically to try and build relationships between, small producers or industry folks with the regulatory community to try and build relationships there so there can be more safe information exchange, more sort of proactive information exchange. That's a place where information could be flowing in a more constructive mm-hmm. way, I would suggest. And then I do want to just reinforce that our extension efforts at the land-grant institutions around the world still exist and play an important role in communicating about what's going on in the university, learning about the needs of producers, smallholders, et cetera, and trying to feed that information back to researchers so they know, where the big mm-hmm. issues are. So I do want to just reinforce, extension is something that has continued to kind of reinvent itself and re-envision what it can be. And I think that's the place where we can look to help bridging this gap.
Right. That's the answer I get most often when I ask this question is that's the role of extension. And so I went to extension folks and they said, well, if I had more hours in the day, they're very good about, at least many of them I've spoken with, they're very open to talking with people if they get questions and meeting with people, but they don't have the bandwidth to actually go out proactively and maybe hiring some more folks that's their primary role would be helpful. Everyone's overworked these days, so I think that's...
Well, I do want to just point out, and you're probably aware of this, but that there is eXtension, capital Xtension, right, now that exists, that is a national extension network. And it's really focused around using technology in a more proactive way to provide information to the people who need it. Mm-hmm. And we've done some work on antimicrobial resistance, and we've, for example, created resources on the eXtension platform. It's really, they have what's called a knowledge sharing platform that's really centered around sharing best practices, lessons learned, trends in particular topical areas. So we've used that as a platform for some of the work we've done on antimicrobial resistance fairly successfully. So I would also just advocate for that.
That's great.
Which it doesn't require the kind of bandwidth, right, that you're talking,
true,
about.
But
there's, so I guess my two answers would be, I do believe that there remains a role for extension in a re-envisioned role as they continue to try and do that. And then I would also just advocate for thinking about how networks work and who are the important people in local networks and finding those mm-hmm. people and talking to them about these issues.
Yeah, certainly I agree that there are a lot of resources available, a lot of really great resources available, and it's just connecting the people who need those resources and letting them know that they are available. I think sometimes they don't know what they don't know, if you know what I mean.
No, I do. And I think what this kind of goes back to is sometimes we develop resources in the absence of really understanding what people believe they
right.
need, right?
Right.
And so there are a lot of resources out there that maybe people just don't need them.
Right.
Right. And so that's why they're not. And that's, you know, people are operating under this just-in-time mode of dealing with risks in many cases. So they're going after information when
right.
they need it, as opposed to just looking at stuff proactively.
Right. So Maria, as we wrap up today, what is your hope that the food industry can learn to adopt for their own business purposes in terms of risk communication, whether it's a better sense of why it's important and how they can do it more effectively? What's your take?
Well, I want to just say a couple of things. One is I want to reinforce this idea that communication is important, but it's really only a small piece of how you operate as an organization. And so having good practices, transparent practices, processes in place for risk management, all those things are a key part of any organization. So I don't want to oversell the role of communication in this, but I will say that I see risk communication and taking risk communication processes seriously as a financial decision on the part of a company. There's lots of, if you wanted to Google around right now, there's a lot of information about how important brand protection is and how dependent it is on how negative events are handled by a company. I would just reinforce that there's a financial aspect to how you think about risk communication and whether you're willing to invest in that. The sort of two big things that I emphasize when I teach risk communication classes is the importance of communication planning and being thoughtful about how communication exists, and particular risk communication exists within your organization. And if you're engaging in risk communication planning, making that an ongoing, important, central part of how you do business. And I really think that should be driven by engaging with your consumers, engaging with the people who use your products or could be potential consumers of a product in a meaningful way to understand how your product fits with their needs, what their existing behaviors are, et cetera. So those are kind of the two big things I would emphasize.
Yeah, I think your point about transparency is really well taken, because the companies who have been able to survive, massive events, crisis events, have done so because they've been willing to be very open and transparent about what happened and the changes that they were going to make going forward. So,
yeah, and I think this is an ongoing challenge, given the sort of regulatory environment, the business environment, the sort of unwillingness for organizations to share with one another about what's going on. So that's often hard to learn lessons from the way things are handled, because a lot of that information is not
right.
proprietary or shared or whatever. So that's an ongoing thing. And you see in some, when there was the National Center for Food Protection and Defense, for example, that was really designed to foster those relationships so there could be information sharing among a variety of stakeholders in the food system. You see this around counterfeiting of products. We have an initiative here at Michigan State that really tries to build relationships between all the stakeholders in this counterfeit products space, because there's so many lessons that we can learn from one another about how companies and the regulatory community are dealing with these issues. So I think this is an ongoing challenge that is been there historically in the food safety space, and I think it continues to be a challenge.
Certainly does. I want to thank you so much, Maria, for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Dr. Maria Lipinski for joining us today, and many thanks to all of you for listening. Please don't forget, send us your feedback for our year-end episode that we'll post on December 11th, and we'll need to hear from you no later than December 5th. We'd love for you to share your thoughts about your year in food safety. What was your biggest challenge or success? What were your lessons learned? One of our favorite topics this year. And maybe what was your favorite episode? Reach out via email at podcast@foodsafetymagazine.com, via Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook, or record that voice memo and email it to us. You can find links to all the references that we mentioned in our episode in our show notes. You can access those in your podcast player or on our website at foodsafetymagazine.com/podcast, and then look for episode 38. I hope that you've subscribed to our podcast. And if you haven't, do it now. It's just a click away. Maybe you're already subscribed, but you haven't weighed in with a review yet. You can do that. Or if you don't want to write a full review, you can just rate the podcast. Throw some stars our way. It really helps people to find the podcast, and, well, we kind of get a kick out of it too, so we appreciate it. That's it for us today. Our next regular episode and our last episode of the year will post on December 11th. We'll talk to you then.